El Salvador went from having the highest homicide rate in the world to more recently seeing its lowest rate in decades. As his approval ratings show, one man has gotten a lot of the credit.
He recently went down in popularity to 88%.
No. Then I went up to 91 again.
Yes, I was going to get my question out.
Nayib Bukele is Latin America's youngest president, a millennial known for his frequent tweets who's framed himself as a fresh face and outsider. But more recently, he drew attention for releasing photos of imprisoned gang members locked together in human chains. I'm Karin Zissas of ASCOA Online. In this episode, I spoke with Tiziano Breda, Central America analyst of International Crisis Group. He talked with me about the degree to which Bukele's security strategy is behind the homicide decrease, why the president is willing to risk global criticism about his handling of prisoners, and why dialogue with gangs might be a long-term answer to keeping violence rates down.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Tiziano, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much to you, Karin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, in 2015, El Salvador had the highest murder rate in the world. And since then, and in the first year of the presidency of Nayib Bukele, homicides dropped to their lowest rate in decades. And that drop came before the coronavirus pandemic. So can you tell us to start off, what's behind that drop in the homicide rate in El Salvador?
So, before Bukele took the presidency in June 2019, of course, as you were mentioning, homicide levels were already on a downward trend, which was mainly due to basically all-out war that was waged by the state and security forces against gangs, and combined with very tough measures in prisons that halted or hindered the communications between gangs in jail and outside jails. But since Bukele took office, the decrease has been really drastic, and basically homicide levels have plunged to historical lows. The government ascribes it to its security strategy, which is named Territorial Control Plan. But we in Crisis Group have found reasons to doubt that this could be the sole cause behind it, for several reasons, both because most of the measures that have been taken resemble somehow the attempts from previous administrations, which didn't provide these stark and immediate results, and also statistical evidence disprove a bit the government's rhetoric. So we think that's more likely to be a gang's decision to scale back the use of violence, as happened in other occasions in the country in recent history, and probably as part of an informal understanding between gangs and authorities.
And why would gangs come to that kind of understanding? Why would they cut back on violence?
Gangs could decide to scale back violence for various reasons. First of all, they've learned that the use of violence and homicides levels are a political tool. So they can use it because it's the increase in homicides has a really great political electoral cost for the politicians that are ruling the country. And secondly, if there are changes in the security policies of a government and there are, goodwill signs or at least, intentions to change the approach that is being based on law enforcement and so-called iron fist measures of the past few decades, they might also recognize in this attempt and, want to move forward, basically, and try to give a chance to the current government.
So you mentioned that the Bukele government has this territorial control plan, and you sort of hinted that maybe it's not that different from prior strategies in terms of trying to eliminate violence. What is different about it? What's the same? Tell us a little bit more about what's wrapped up in Bukele's territorial control plan.
Well, yeah, most of the initiatives that have been taken so far resemble the attempts from previous administration. And we're talking about, for example, military and police deployments, mass detentions, tough confinement measures in prisons, etc. But on paper, the plan on which the territorial control plan draws from is the Cuscatlan plan, which is the plan that Bukele presented for its presidency, which includes elements that would shift away basically from this exclusively focused on law enforcement measures. Two aspects that we identify as possibly innovative in Bukele's approach is precisely the intervention, the local intervention in marginalized communities, gang control communities, through this unit newly created called the Unit for the Reconstruction of the Social Fabric, which actually seemed to go in the direction of providing these communities for spaces to gather, for opportunities for their youngsters, and leisure centers, and through the construction of these cubes, which is the basically the insignia that we identify of this plan in that regard. So there are some elements that could go in that direction.
I wanted to ask about these cubes because I read them referenced in your report. What are these cubes? Why are they called cubes?
They are called cubes because actually their shape is that of a cube. So they are basically leisure centers or gathering spaces, which are to be built in marginalized communities, often stigmatized for the presence of gangs in those communities. And they're really striking in the impact that they might have on the community. So far, just one exists, and I had the pleasure to visit it. It's in the Iberia community in the outskirts of San Salvador. And you could really see from local dwellers the impact that this high-tech, you know, glass window building put at the center of a very poor marginalized community, and involving activities going from IT training, English lessons, to, dance classes or photo workshops, etc., could have on the community, on the youngsters to be occupied, to not just wander in the streets, to learn something and to basically build hope for you also finding a job afterwards.
I know that in your report you talk about having sorts of initiatives that would mitigate violence. You also talked a little bit in the report that, I mean, let's step back and say, the report is called Miracle or Mirage, Gangs and Plunging Violence in El Salvador. And I thought that was very intriguing, this miracle or mirage idea around kind of what we see, the images that are put forth, and what might actually be happening. And in the report, you mentioned that also that there are some signs that given the areas that the Bukele government has focused on, I believe it's 22 areas in the country, what we're seeing in terms of homicide rates don't necessarily correlate with where they've been focusing the energy in terms of trying to mitigate violence. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is among the reasons why we doubt that the territorial control plan is exclusively the sole cause behind this drop. Because we combined in the report statistical analysis to the homicide figures, the data that we have available for the country, and to see possible correlation or not with policy measures. And basically, as you were mentioning, we found out that, first of all, the plan focuses so far on 22 prioritized municipalities, whereas the drop is nationwide. Most of the municipalities around the country, across the country, have experienced a stark decrease in these levels of violence. And actually, some of the municipalities prioritized under the plan have even experienced a slight increase in levels of violence over the past year. That's the first reason that we made us doubt about the plan. The second is also the fact that no launch of any initiative of the plan, of the imposition, for example, of states of emergencies in prisons, etc., had an immediate significant impact on levels of trends of violence, which actually started to decrease before Bukele took office and steadily went down until the historical lows that we experienced this year. And we basically warned that if the plan is not the sole cause, and if actually it's a sort of an informal understanding that's progressively being built between gangs and the state, it's still a very fragile and very easily reversible equilibrium, which events like the late April uptick in violence, which took the life of 85 people in a five-day span, compared to previous levels of homicide, which ranged around 2 daily homicides in March, show precisely that gangs still have the power and the capacity to alter these trends of violence if they consider to do so. So we believe that's neither a miracle nor a mirage, but it's certainly a positive, incredibly positive result, which needs to be consolidated, though, because it's not, it's not solid.
Okay, I have about 5 questions I could ask you about what you just said. But let's talk first a little bit about Bukele, because I want to get into this idea of gang truces and some of the things you mentioned here. But first, for people who may not be as familiar with El Salvador, let's talk about Bukele as a leader, because he's drawn a lot of attention. He's young. He spends a lot of time on Twitter. He's branded himself as this outsider. And early on, there was quite a lot of positive international coverage about him. But since he took office, there have been things that have been ringing alarm bells. Like, in particular, even before the coronavirus pandemic, he came into conflict with some of the institutions. He took over the Legislative Assembly, sending armed authorities into the Legislative Assembly, specifically over funding for the territorial control plan. So this is all connected. And what really captured the world's attention is related to this weekend of violence you just referred to in April. After that happened, Bukele tweeted photos of masses of gang members in prisons chained together. And it was just there were very evocative images. There was a global outcry from human rights groups. Now, why would he do something that would bring such negative worldwide attention?
Well, first of all, we have to separate the public figure from the very much more pragmatic private one. Bukele, since he took office with great popularity, great results in the security realm, etc., but has been or still is quite weak in the control that he wants to have in other states' institutions, including the Legislative Assembly. We have to consider that the party he ran with, which is not the party he created because he couldn't register it on time for the elections. So he ran for another party, which only has 11 seats out of the 84 of the Legislative Assembly. So in order to maintain the popularity, he basically embarked or continued this anti-system, very belligerent discourse against the what are now the opposition's parties, the historical parties in the country, the FMLN, left wing, and ARENA, right wing, to basically boost and continue to nurture the support he needs for next year's elections, which are the general elections for the Legislative Assembly and also at the municipal level. These tweets that you were mentioning basically serves this purpose, because of course the rejection towards gangs in the country and the rejections towards opposition parties, which have lost opportunities to tackle properly the issue of security in the country for decades. They've been tainted by corruption scandals over the past few years, etc. These two quite impressive events, which are the 9th of February, the military occupation of the Legislative Assembly, and these pictures took of gang members in prison, rammed together, dehumanized, etc., both serves this public rejection of these two actors in the Salvadoran society. But besides that, And privately, he is a way more pragmatic person, knows that has to change approach in certain issues. And so, I mean, this is the first, I think, difference that we should, first of all, line out. And, of course, he's aware that the international support for his policy, for his government, is very much important. But at the same time, his main goal is, again, next year's election. So I think he's tried to recover his image internationally after the events of the 9th of February, for example, by being recognized as one of the, you know, the pioneers, so to say, or those leaders that have taken preventive measures, the strongest preventive measures to avoid the spread of the coronavirus when it hit, when it started to hit Latin America. And he knows that through his communications ability, he can shape, can mold both the public debate and also the international community's perception of him somehow at the later stage.
Mm-hmm. Now we're gonna have to talk about the pandemic and his handling of it, of course. But I want to get back to something that's mentioned in the report and relates to Bukele's very high popularity. This isn't the first time El Salvador has seen its murder rates go up and down. And in around 2012, 2013, there was a gang truce, at which point violence went down a great deal. One of the things that you recommend in the report is that the Bukele government should look into engaging in dialogue with the gangs in order to maintain these low levels of violence. Isn't that pretty risky? I mean, those negotiations with gangs were quite controversial for the public. Wouldn't he be potentially sacrificing his high approval if he did that?
Well, that's, of course, the $1 million question. We start from the assumption that basically due to the gang's presence in over 90% of the country's territory, according to police estimates, and given the amount of membership, I mean, we're talking about around 60,000 gang members plus a network of around 6 people per gang member, which are either collaborators or family members and live off gangs' activities such as extortion, etc. So we're talking about more or less 400,000 people in a country of 6.5 million that are related somehow to gangs. And the interaction with gangs is basically unavoidable at the local level to do things as simple as entering a community or bringing some, you know, projects and providing some services from the state, etc. So we believe that, of course, the problem with the truce gang was that it was flawed in its design, it was half-hearted in its implementation, it did not have a forward-looking objective. It was focusing precisely on just dropping down the levels of homicides for the costs that the increase in homicides has, as I was mentioning earlier on. So eventually derailed for the way it was handled, and the high rejection that you have at the public level towards this kind of process is precisely due to how it was handled and the consequences that the failure of that process had in terms of violence, because after it fell apart, levels of violence went up again and reached the historical levels of 103 murders per 100,000 inhabitants, which made El Salvador the world's murder capital in the world. So we basically think that if there's a character, if there's a public figure that really can be in the position, in the unprecedented position of having an incredible high approval rate from the public and an incredible ability to shape and influence the public debate and basically legitimize, no, even measures such as, or initiatives such as, the militarization of the National Assembly, and possibly a year from now, some months from now, also in the strong negotiating position in the Legislative Assembly through a possible victory, that is Bukele, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he has the political capital that prior leaders potentially did not, basically.
Exactly.
So let's get to the pandemic. We know that Bukele has also had a particularly strict approach around quarantining and very strict measures of containment for the coronavirus pandemic. To what degree has the pandemic itself helped to decrease levels of violence in El Salvador?
Well, of course, the pandemic has an immediate impact in March in the whole region when the first lockdowns, quarantines, border shutdowns, etc., measures were taken by the various Central American governments. Because, of course, that those measures altered the way in which daily life, you know, was carried on and how also gangs operated. Of course, there's another element that gangs pointed out in interviews publicly, which is the fact that the fear at contagion, of course, of a gang member or its relative, etc., could lead to leave this person unattended by public, you know, health officials and the public health system. So, of course, these two issues, and plus the third, which is the shutdown of a lot of economic activities, including public transport, which is crucial to basically gangs' activities in terms of extortion and drives. It's a major driver for also levels of violence towards people who don't pay the extortion. Of course, these elements contributed initially to a drop in homicide. And actually, March was, of course, before May, the month with the least violent month in decades. But if you look at elsewhere in the region, gangs have rapidly, and other criminal groups have rapidly adapted to the current situation, and levels of homicides in, for example, neighboring Guatemala and Honduras are back to pre-crisis levels, which means that it can't be the sole explanation behind the current low levels of homicides. And there's actually a sort of a collaboration or a common objective that has been pointed out by gangs in the state, which is a common commitment, a shared commitment to try and contain the spread of the virus, to try and order the daily life and respect social distancing, avoid gatherings and crowds, etc., which is impressive how it went in the same direction, the gang's attitude towards that and the government's perspective.
So we've just been talking about the pandemic, and there's no way to look at what's happening in El Salvador without considering how it's connected to everything globally. After all, we know that people have been emigrating from El Salvador in part due to violence that they face at home. So what kind of role can the international community play, and particularly the United States, which has played a complicated and an important role in El Salvador's history? What can the international community do to aid in terms of mitigating violence?
As you were mentioning, starting from the assumption that Salvadorans are among the Central American nationalities who are the most fleeing out of the country and cite the most violence as among the main reasons that press them to leave their country and seek asylum in most cases elsewhere. We don't have to all forget that Salvadorans, according to the UN Refugee Agency, are, I think, the sixth nationality worldwide for applications of asylum worldwide, because of the presence, really, and the rooted presence of the gangs throughout the territory. So, starting from this assumption, the US and the international community, more broadly speaking, could play a role in assisting the government in three main areas we identify in the report. First of all, try and tie the economic assistance and the aid that has been channeled to El Salvador in the various realms to the respect for the democratic rules and also advising the government to avoid turning the security issue into a highly charged wedge issue against its opponents, because that hinders the possibility of building more nationwide intersectorial support that is needed to implement the necessary measures nationally and locally to really tackle in the medium to long run the problem of gangs. They secondly could assist the government in investing more and better in these prevention policy and local development projects at the local level in marginalized communities, for example, in these cubes, but improving the design and the more tailored, for example, job-related training, which is a bit missing, also the sustainability of these projects, which are extremely costly and unsustainable whenever there might be, you know, a change in the political realm and withdrawal support. They would just, you know, be dead there as giant elephants in marginalized communities, but abandoned at some point. Mm-hmm. And the third realm, we think, in the security, more probably related to security, is to insist with the Salvadoran government to improve and strengthen the internal accountability measures in the security forces, because the impunity, the environment of impunity that's been built over the past few years, made the levels of violence perpetrated by security forces and abuses by security forces an increasingly important driver for violence in the country. And we also suggest that the openness of the government to build on an international community against impunity in El Salvador, which is sort of a contrary trend to, if compared to the neighboring countries, which just shut down similar experiences as the CICIG in Guatemala and the MAXI in Honduras. Mm-hmm. And we think the international community could build on this apparent openness to actually install a similar commission drawing from the experience in Guatemala, which can help improve the trainings and the investigative capacity of the security forces and the coordination between the police and the Attorney General's office, which are also critical to reduce impunity, not only within security forces, but in general, which we believe is also a major factor in providing or hindering the production of violence in the country.
Great. Thank you so much, Tiziano, for speaking with me today and really giving us a great view into what's happening in terms of violence rates in El Salvador.
Thank you very much to you, Karin, for the invitation. It's a pleasure, and I look forward to collaborating with you in future opportunities.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissas. This episode was produced by Luisa Lemmy. Check our podcast notes for a link to the International Crisis Group report mentioned in this conversation. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. Check out concerts online at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can help us get the word out. Give us 5 stars, write us a review, share, and subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.